This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3629 for Thursday, the 30th of June, 2022. Today's show is entitled Linux in Laws SAI, the show with Red Panda's Mosaic Killers and Metal Corrosion. It is part of the series Linux in Laws. It is the 60th show of Monochromic and is about 73 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is an interview with Eric Rescorla of Firefox, CTO on browsers, the internet, and hardcore sci-fi.
This is Linux in Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. This is Linux in Laws episode... No, season one, episode something, to be determined later. Martin, how are things?
Yeah, things are back to normal. It's raining in the UK. So.
It's raining in the UK?
It is.
Whatever happened to global warming?
Yeah, not available here. Yeah.
Okay. So Greta didn't stop by?
Yes.
Can't complain.
Good.
Greta didn't stop by recently?
I don't think so. No, she was otherwise engaged.
Yeah. I see. Fair enough. No, I'm fine. It hasn't rained here in ages, so I reckon all the rain has been moving to the UK. So that's probably in order because, as we all know, the Met Office normally in the UK, full disclosure, in case you didn't know this yet, the summer is normally supposed to happen between the 13th and 14th of August, somewhere around lunchtime.
No, much earlier than that. It's usually June or May or something. And then
but only for half an hour, right?
You can be lucky if you have a day or so.
You could put the heating outside and turn on the...
yes.
What I'm looking for.
Talking about heating, how many showers have you had these days?
About twice a day, but only cold because of the gas situation, as you're apparently aware of.
The message is getting through. Yeah.
But Martin, what is the situation with lorry drivers and what's what I'm looking for? Wheat and sunflower once again in the UK. I heard that you're facing desperate times.
Not as far as I know, we can buy bread.
So supply chain's in order.
Yeah, nothing new here. Yeah.
It pays to cozy up with the Russians, right?
I don't know. You tell me. or maybe you should ask your chancellor.
She's gone, I'm afraid.
No, the new guy. What's his name?
Olaf Scholz.
Yes, him. Yes. He's a bit dodgy, isn't he?
Well, you tell me. I don't follow German politics as much as you do, apparently. But this is not the podcast about politics, never mind German or English or British anyway. Without further ado, we would like to introduce Eric Rescorla. For those two listeners in the audience who do not know who Eric Rescorla is, maybe Eric, you can introduce yourself.
Good morning. Nice to be here. So I'm the CTO for Firefox. I work at Mozilla, which is the company that makes Firefox. I lead a small team that does a bunch of things, including technical strategy, standards, a bunch of advanced work, advanced technology type work. My main area of expertise is in communication security, and I did a lot of work on TLS, which is the main protocol that powers web security. Most recently, I was the editor for the new version of the specification, which now secures, I guess, about half the internet transactions done over the web.
That was comprehensive. Thank you, Eric. Maybe for, I think we have 8 listeners now, but maybe there's one among these 8 who doesn't know what Firefox is, never mind the Mozilla Foundation and Corporation. So why don't you give a little bit of background of the browser, the corporation, and the foundation, and maybe even the ecosystem surrounding it?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, obviously, Firefox is a web browser. If you use Chrome or you use Safari, well, you should try Firefox. Firefox is an open source browser, which means you know, the source code is all available. You could build it yourself, or you can get it from us. It's built by sort of a combination of a community open source process and also by a set of people who work for the Mozilla Corporation, which is a sort of Mozilla's an interesting entity because we have this corporation which is then wholly owned by the Mozilla Foundation, which is a nonprofit. And so the overall mission of Mozilla as a whole is to make the internet better. We have a whole set of slogans around this, but the overall mission is to make the internet better. And so, the way this works is that the corporation builds products and the foundation has a set of larger initiatives around, things like trustworthy AI or privacy on privacy, evaluating privacy products or public mobilization around important policy questions. So, we work together, the foundation, the corporation, with the foundation taking care, I think, of sort of maybe one can think of the bigger picture stuff and the corporation taking care of the product-oriented stuff. Hmm.
That was a high-level overview. Full disclosure, people, I've been using Firefox since 2001 or 1999. I still have that T-shirt saying Firefox for beta tester that I think the foundation sent me, or even the project, because not too sure when the corporation was founded, but it's still blue and the writing is fading. That T-shirt, I might add, is about at least 13 years old. Four came out officially in 2011, maybe 2012. Correct me if I'm wrong, Eric. And the beta phase entered before I moved house, and that must have been 2009, 2008. That T-shirt has survived various attempts of kidnapping it, never mind stealing, but I always managed to get it back, and it holds a kind of a place dear or close to my heart, because Firefox is the browser that I use on a daily basis, in contrast to other people like my cherished co-host, who strains every now and then, apparently. I've been following the project through the peaks and the troughs, but maybe now's the time to shed some light on the history of that browser, maybe starting even with Netscape and what happened afterwards, if that's
sure.
All right.
I can try. I actually joined Mozilla in 2013, so but I've been working on the web for a long time, so I have some perspective. So, as people probably know, the first real commercial web browser was Netscape, which I think, in fact, was probably the first really big Silicon Valley, startup.com hit. And so Netscape was very popular at the time. And then...
This is mid-90s, right?
This is mid-90s, correct. Thank you, yes. And then what happened is you may remember this company Microsoft, and they brought out their own web browser. It was at the time called Internet Explorer.
Yeah. Martin is our resident Microsoft expert. I'm not.
Yeah.
And so, the consequence of having, your product ship on, be mostly used on someone else's product, having them ship their browser by default, and so people have to download your browser, is that, it has a negative impact on your market share. And so Netscape was not doing as well as one would have liked. And towards sort of the end of like Netscape's lifespan, they decided to open source the code. And so there's this large project to open source the code and to build a new browser, which ended up being Firefox. And that went through, as I say, that sort of before my time, but that went through a bunch of kind of like iterations. but eventually it became with Firefox. And like Firefox still does include some, you know, a lot of that code was rewritten, but a lot of that code is still there. And in fact, I've worked quite a bit on the security portions of Firefox, and the security library NSS like goes back to the very early days of Netscape. And so, you know, Firefox was really the first, you know, big open source browser. And the first one to really where you could have all the source out there and you could work on it and you could read it yourself and you could build it yourself. And much of the work on Firefox was done by people who volunteered and just volunteered the time and contributed to Firefox. And some of those people like now work for us, and some of those people, you know, worked for us in the past, and some of those people still volunteer, and some of those people now work on Chrome or Safari actually. So it's really with the beginning of this big ecosystem of the open sourcing of the web.
Wow. And I think this is still lingering on. I just have to take a look at the rendering engines. For those people who just look at a browser all day long, the rendering engine is essentially the piece of software that takes HTML and CSS and some other components like JavaScript and puts them into pictures, laid out text and all the rest of it. And and the whole, this whole notion of, I wouldn't say browser wars, but to some extent, at least the competition that has been going on also boils down to rendering engines. Because if we take a look at browser history, there are a couple of competing rendering engines, and then multiple browsers, let's put it this way, have been using these rendering engines. Bing comes to mind, sorry, Bing or Bing, I can't even remember. Gecko, of course, which was, I think, the first Firefox rendering engine, if I'm not completely mistaken. And then Quantum, but we're going to talk about Quantum and Rust in a minute, as this is, apart from other things, the Rust marketing podcast, as we all know it.
That.
Yes, and some other, and I mean, for example, and of course, I think there are three main rendering engines. It's Chrome is based on Bling, if I'm not mistaken, Safari on WebKit, and Firefox on Gecko, and now Quantum, if I'm completely mistaken.
So I think, as you say, the history is like very complicated. So, you know, Gecko is the historical name.
Don't worry, we have about 4 hours left, so go right ahead.
Fantastic. I love talking about rendering engines, so that's good. So when I got into the business around 2013, there were three engines largely. There was WebKit, which powered Safari and Chrome, and then there was I'm trying to remember what Microsoft called theirs. I think it was Trident at the time, and then there was Gecko, which powered Firefox. And shortly thereafter, Google decided, so Google and Apple collaborated on WebKit. So as you say, the story is that there's the engine, which just drives the networking and the JavaScript and displays the HTML, and there's the stuff around it, you know, the menu bars and stuff like that. And actually, fun story, the technical term for that stuff, for the menu bars and the URL bar, and that is Chrome. That's what everybody calls, called browser Chrome, and that's where the name Chrome comes from. So shortly thereafter, I guess in like 13 or 14, Google decided that they didn't want to collaborate with Apple anymore on WebKit, and so they forked it. And so they built, so Blink is a WebKit fork. And so then for a while, there were four engines, four major engines. There was Blink, there was WebKit, there was, I guess, as I say, Trident, there was Gecko. And that like went on for a long time. And then, you know, two other things happened, as you indicated. Microsoft took a stab at rewriting their entire system. They had an engine called Spartan, and that's what Edge was originally built on. And then eventually they decided they were just going to use Chromium. So Chromium is also an open source project, is the basis of Chrome. And they said, well, we're going to take Chromium and make Edge out of Chromium. And so now there are three engines again, which is to say Chromium. WebKit and Gecko. So you were alluding to Quantum. So Quantum, I think, you know, our branding has been a little confusing here, but really Quantum was the name for the project that initially was the name for the project that we'd had to revitalize Gecko. So Gecko had gotten less attention perhaps than it needed over the years, and it had gotten kind of slow and kind of crufty in a bunch of ways. And so we had a big project that was designed to really revitalize Gecko. And that had a bunch of different components, some of which were taking in modern technologies from this servo experimental browser that had been built in Rust, as you said, at Mozilla. So that's where our new CSS system came from. It's also where our new graphics rendering system came from. So some of it was that. And then some of it was really just fit and finish. So we had this big project that was called Quantum Flow that was like find every piece of jank in the system. So jank is the technical term in browsers for like when you type a key and nothing happens, or when you try to like pull a menu bar and nothing happens and it takes a second or two, that's jank. And so we basically went through, and this guy, Ehsan Aghari, led this project where he went through and basically he and a bunch of people found every single place in the system they could find where there was jank, and then we tried to systematically remove them. And so Quantum was the name for that project. And then by the time we were done, people felt like Quantum had actually become something different and became a good way to talk about Firefox. And so that's how Firefox Quantum, came to be a thing. I will say, you know, we internally largely just say Gecko still, but Quantum is definitely a name that gets used as well.
That's a very interesting perspective, because at the end of the day, I think Mozilla's engineers, and I reckon I'm talking about the community as well as the people employed by Mozilla Corporation, weren't too happy with the performance of the existing rendering engine. But before we go into the technical details, maybe we should explain what HTML. Well, I reckon everybody knows what HTML is, but CSS plays a very important part here too, because CSS drives the rendering in terms of styles, because CSS stands for cascading style sheets. So essentially, for those people who do not know this, you take HTML. HTML is simply a markup language, and CSS gives it fancy looks. Let's put it this way. Needless to say, that requires a lot of software work in the background. Gecko, as far as I can recall, and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, was a single-threaded, maybe multi-process rendering engine. And the idea behind Servo and subsequently Quantum was to introduce a significantly higher level of parallelism into the rendering as such, making or improving the overall rendering speed significantly. Full disclosure, we had about 50% of our episodes were on Rust. Check out the back catalog, people. Jokes aside. 50%, Martin, but thanks for the correction. Oh, okay. No, we had Steve Klubnik on from the project itself. There was a high-level Rust overview, and with some forthcoming episodes, blatant teaser, will have the Rust Foundation being present on this podcast. But given the fact that you are the CTO, Eric, maybe you can talk about a little bit about the internal things, if you can, that led to the foundation of this, I'm almost tempted to say, en vogue hipster programming language in Mozilla terms and beyond. Because if you take a look at the recent investments across the industry, I'm talking the likes of Google, the likes of Microsoft, and all the rest of them, the Rust adoption is heavy as a system program and as a systems program language, left, right, and center across the tier one, tier twos in the industry. But maybe given the fact that, okay, it was a little bit before your time, but I reckon Rust still plays an important role at Mozilla as such.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a lot to talk about there. So feel free to jump in. Rust was started before I got to Mozilla, but certainly much of the work was done after I was there, though not my team. Maybe it's helpful to start with like a brief discussion of like what Rust is and why it's important in this case, right?
Absolutely.
So like most browsers are written in C++. C++ is a very old language. It's based on C. And from an era when people thought that certain things were the programmer's responsibility as opposed to the responsibility of the language. So as a concrete example, people thought memory management was a program responsibility. So you want to allocate some memory. You want to make sure that you don't accidentally like go like right outside the memory. That's like your job as a programmer, right? And, or as another example, you want to write a multi-threaded program, which runs in, you know, multiple threads in the processor at a time. Well, C didn't even really support that to start with. But again, this is like a program responsibility, not to like use the same data in two threads at once, right? And so the idea with Rust is that we've now learned that people cannot program under these conditions. And that if you ask people to program in those environments, they inevitably make mistakes, and those mistakes become, you know, crashers or security vulnerabilities or whatever.
Even if genetically enhanced?
Well,
is it right for programming?
Well, I think we're not there yet, maybe, unfortunately.
Okay.
I'll tell you, so we used to
Google
have,
take note.
Yes. In the San Francisco office of Mozilla, and it may still be there. I haven't been there in a little while. Because we had it closed down for a while. There used to be a sign right above David Barron's desk. David Barron was one of the Mozilla distinguished engineers who worked very much on CSS. And it was the sign was placed at about 8 feet, and it had a line, and it said, "You must be this tall to write multi-threaded code." And so, nice. You know, so the implication, of course, is that nobody can write multi-threaded code without making mistakes. And so, Rust is, you know, one of a new generation, but I think perhaps the leading one of a new generation of programming languages that said that, look, we need to make it so that you can do all these things that you want to do and have them be fast and do systems programming, but they have to be safe at the same time. And I think they still have the slogan, hack without fear. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about doing all the things you want to do. You want it multi-threaded code, you want it very performant code, but you want it to be that if you don't make mistakes, it's not catastrophic, right? And so that's what Rust enables. And so Rust was originally started, as you say, in great part to like build a new web engine, Servo. Oh yeah, so yeah. And so we had this project for quite some time, Servo, which was basically building an entirely new engine out of Rust, in Rust. And at the same time, we had people starting to build components in Firefox in Rust as well. So, but I think what Rust brings to the party, and as opposed to say Go or Swift, I think, which are the other sort of languages that people often think of in the same category, is that it's really designed to be a systems programming language. And what I mean by that is it's really designed to displace C++. And so, concretely, there's not like a garbage collector, so you don't have to take stalls every so often with the garbage collector, you know, has to reclaim memory. And so Rust is designed to like kind of behave like C++, but to be like just as fast, but safer to write in. So for obvious reasons, there's a lot of interest of that in the browser community. And now what we're seeing is interest in other communities as well, which is, as you were alluding to, that kind of investment. We make, as I say, modestly heavy use of Rust. You know, what we've typically done is two things. We've written new components in Rust. So there's this new networking protocol called Quick and we wrote the entire implementation in Rust. And then we've taken things out of Servo and we brought them in Rust. And then I think finally, every so often we'll find something that is like so terrible that like it just needs to be rewritten. And in those cases, we often rewrite it in Rust. So an example of that is the URL parser got pretty substantially rewritten, and that was rewritten in Rust. So I think, you know, it's always very difficult when you're working in an old code base to know when it's good to rewrite things or when it's good to just fix them up in place, even if they're kind of gross. But we do. But the typical bias here is when you write something new, think about Rust.
Interesting, because apparently Mozilla put a lot of money into the development of language and its ecosystem. But I can recall, and this is probably getting a bit controversial now, I can recall a couple of years back that quite a few people had to leave Mozilla. And also the Rust Foundation was set up. Can you spill some beans on this one?
Yeah. So I think that the way to think about this is Mozilla started Rust. And we thought it was very important to have it. And we think it's been really good for the ecosystem. But we didn't want to own Rust. And you know, we wanted the Rust to be something the community owned, not something that Mozilla owned. And so for quite some time, we'd wanted to figure out how to like stop having it be something where, you know, all the engineers work for us and we kind of made the decisions and have it be something that had its own, that stood on its own feet. And so, you know, the idea behind the Rust Foundation was to have that place. Like that's probably like the closest answer. You know, we still are heavily involved with that. One of the people on my team is on the board of the Rust Foundation. So, but we fundamentally wanted this to be a community effort, not something that was all owned in perpetuity.
Martin, sorry, you had a question too. If Martin hasn't fallen asleep yet, if he has, I'm simply gonna go next.
Just keep talking, yeah.
Sorry, yes.
Martin, wait, you're awake.
I was just following the Rust conversation.
No. Martin, I told you to take the meds, didn't you?
Well, the problem is whatever. I did, yeah.
Glad you did, yes. Anyway, go ahead, Martin, Mr. Wizard.
Yeah, I think as part of your job, you mentioned you you have a lot to do with standards.
Yes.
And the browsing is one of the most, let's call it hackable types of activities these days. Certain airlines come to mind, and et cetera. But how much of that work takes up your job, and how much do you look to the open source community to help with all that, these kind of standards?
Well, I mean, it's a big effort. It's a big group effort, right? So I think, you know, we have people across the organization and also people we engage in with the open source community to develop standards. We try to, I think, weigh in where our voice will matter the most, and, you know, not weigh in places where our voice won't matter. So, you know, that's a combination of our expertise, I think, and, you know, the expertise of the personnel we have, as well as places where we have a real, a real investment, right? So, you know, if it's HTML or CSS, then we like engage pretty heavily. And, you know, there are other places, I think, where, you know, we've engaged less heavily, you know, so we don't engage in like congestion control, like internet congestion control very much. Like other people care about that. We're glad it's being done. We think it's important, but like we don't have anybody in Mozilla who's like an expert on congestion control. So we don't work on that at that level, you know, say Google does, right? So, you know, there's this new congestion control algorithm called BBR that Google designed, and like it's nice work, but you know, we didn't work on like standardizing that kind of stuff. So, I mean, my team specifically focuses, I think, as I sort of indicated, largely on networking stuff. So, you know, security, transport protocols, you know, audio and video. So I and a bunch of people on my team, as well as many other people at Mozilla, worked on WebRTC, which is the specification mm-hmm. that's letting us have this conversation.
Yeah.
So I think those are places where I think Mozilla's had important, valuable influences. And I think that there are other places where, you know, like I say, we're happy to let other people pick up the ball. Maybe another example of a place where I think there's been excellent work that we participated in some and are pulled back from a little bit, but other people put the ball is in audio and video codecs, where you know there's this alliance for open media, which is standardizing AV1. I guess Apple has standardized AV1, so I think they're on the AV2 now. And so you know that's a great example of where other people are doing fantastic work that we're excited to support and happy is happening.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. So you focus on it's that, I guess the audio and video you implement as part of the other standards that other people build, but the networking side makes sense.
And one thing I would add is that I think that we work very closely with our counterparts at Apple and Microsoft and Google and Chrome especially, Google in particular and Safari. And you know. I think there's very much a feeling like that we're all kind of on the same team and we're all trying to make the web better and that, you know, we're all pulling together. And so I wouldn't say there's like a formal division of labor, but definitely we'll have projects where it's like, oh, it's pretty clear that like Mozilla's going to take the lead on this one, or it's pretty clear Google's going to take the lead on this one,
yeah.
Apple's going to take the lead. Yeah. And so I think that's like, you know, it's a very expensive proposition to actually build all this stuff. And so it's helpful to have people like, oh, these guys are going to handle it and we'll follow along.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, there's so many parts to it, right? I mean, there's the you mentioned the audio video, there's the HTML, there's CSS standards, there's JavaScript. You know, as a main browser organization, you obviously don't want to control all those standards. But you mentioned cooperation with some of the other organizations there. Is that in any way, shape, or form formalized, or is that more of a we're working on this, we think this is important, kind of
scenario, or is there an overriding organization that tries to get all these browser builders,
right,
let's put it that way, in the same direction?
So there's several important standards, what's called a standards development organization or standards body, uh-huh, that works on these. So there's W3C, which is like the historical web standards, mm-hmm, organization. There's TC39, which is the historical JavaScript organization. There's What Working Group, which is sort of now doing more of the HTML5 stuff. And then there's ITF, which does networking stuff. So like, you know, we all kind of like participate in all these. And so so as a concrete example, WebRTC was done in a combination of ITF for the networking pieces and for W3C for the HTML and DOM pieces, right? And so we all sort of collaborate at those standards bodies. And then of course there's a bunch of informal collaboration where, you know, we all chat and the people who are working on things talk to each other. And so to give you an example, when we wanted to roll out TLS 1.3, this new version of TLS that I was talking about, you know, I was constantly on the phone or on instant messaging with the people at Chrome and the people at Apple and Safari saying, okay, we think we're ready to do this next, you know, the drafts get done in different versions. And so we're ready to try deploying this next version. And we're ready to deploy it like, you know, next week, right? Or can you do that? And it's not just the browsers, it's also, of course, people like server vendors. So we've worked very close with Cloudflare and with Fastly and Akamai, people like that. And it's the same, mm-hmm, thing, right? There's the informal channels of communication where people know each other and, you know, and that's where, you know, that's how you coordinate when things are going to happen, as well as in the standards body. And it's also how, you know, you get people interested in things. You know, I got an interesting idea, and maybe I talk to somebody else and say, hey, are you interested in doing this? And that's how things get moving, you know, before they get brought to the standards body.
So the next revolution will not necessarily be done in IETF committees, but rather by email or IRC or whatever the hipsters, or Discord, whatever the hipsters use these days.
I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, these, like, the important thing to realize about these standards bodies is that they serve a really important function of coordination and finishing, but they're not really very good at like technology development. And so you really need to have the technology kind of half done by the time you bring it to the standards body, or it's kind of like it's very hard to make progress. And, you know, so I've been involved in a lot of these efforts, and, you know, the ones that work really well are the ones where a pretty small team of people, either inside or outside the standards body, does a lot of the heavy lifting, talk together all the time. And then the sort of bigger community discussions happen once the general contours are put together. So it's still an open process, which is really important, but it's, you know, if the process is open and there are 200 people trying to do something at the very beginning, no one can ever make progress. So it's important to have like the kind of general sense of where you're trying to go set up. And then you start saying, okay, now we're going to have them. And that process will be sort of like mostly open, but it'll be a small group. And then as it gets bigger, you just say, okay, now we understand now we're trying to refine it. And that's when you can take, you know, people say, well, this packet needs to look different, but or this, you know, API needs to look different, but that those are compatible with this sort of, community contribution. And in fact, if you think about that, that's also the same situation with open source, right? Which is the open source projects that really are effective are not ones where someone puts out like one line of code and says, I'm going to build a web browser. They're ones where someone builds a fair fraction of it, and then it's like stone soup and you can put it together. But if, you know, it's just completely like amorphous at the beginning, it's hard to make progress.
A tiny open source project called Linux comes to mind, which operates exactly on that, on these principles.
Precisely.
Martin, any thoughts on how Linux would have been these days if a committee was involved, in terms of, apart from a dictator and some wannabes chipping in code?
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense, right? It's similar to, projects that get submitted to the Apache Foundation. They have to be kind of in some way, shape, or form already usable and formed before they actually go to for applying to these kind of statuses. Otherwise, it's just
I'm beating a dead horse here, but there's a programming language called Ada ring a bell, Martin.
It does.
I wonder. I mean, I think there are about 5 people on the planet that are still, who are still using it. But apart from that,
I feel like they're still using it. It depends if the Netherlands Navy still has submarines, but they probably.
I do not know, but I can recall some piece in the press about a couple of years back that spoke about this. But apart from that, I think nobody uses it. And of course, for those listeners who are not as old as Martin and myself. I can't really talk about Eric. Our ADA was a program language back in the 80s that was designed by a committee. I can't recall which ones. Details maybe in the show notes. Whoa. I do not know if I can dig them up. But it goes to show that these things never really work. And I reckon Rust is the perfect counterexample for this one because a group of people got together. Going back to that, to my favorite program language now, and just did things. Of course, there is now a formal structure in place in the Rust Foundation, and that also handles improvement requests and all the rest of it. But as usual, if you take a close look at the Rust ecosystem, it's almost comparable to Python with PyPy and all the rest of it. I will stop the marketing rant here because there's a recent episode of something called Linux In-Laws that does an excellent job on the Rust marketing. So please, people listen to that. Suffice it to say, with regards to the ecosystem, Rust is rapidly gaining speed here in comparison to the likes of C#, Python, JavaScript, and I'm almost going to say Java with Maven and all the rest of it. But I'm digressing.
Well, I think that I think you're certainly right that Rust is gaining traction. I think that's like really gratifying for people here to see that you know we made the right call. Not me personally, but that Mozilla collectively made the right call. I think you know that there's places for different things, and you know. Certainly, I think JavaScript and Python like play pretty important roles, and I wouldn't expect to see them like plausibly displaced by Rust. I think the things that like Rust is a threat to are C# maybe C++ and C. I guess I would say like it's very hard to explain if you're writing new code like why you'd write like a fresh piece of code why you'd write that in C or C++ at this point. If you're going to let anybody have contact with it like that's adversarial at all. But I think I've certainly done plenty of Rust programming and I've done some JavaScript and Python and like I think the tasks I would do for those are different enough that like if I wanted to process some data I wouldn't use Rust and not to be super fast, right? I'd use Python. And obviously if I wanted to write a web app, I would use JavaScript, right? So I think it's like horses for courses. But I think there's like definitely a niche in the ecosystem. You're certainly right to say there's a niche in the ecosystem that Rust is like kind of like invading and taking over, which I think is healthy.
I mean, there was
you could argue that C++ already took that place from that.
No, Martin, I don't know if that guy called Linus Torvalds rings a bell, who said about 20 years back that C++ won't have a place in the kernel, but he endorsed Rust about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. And it starts with the device drivers, but now more and more Rust is entering the code base. It'll take some time, and full disclosure, we're just coming back from a time traveling exercise, more an upcoming episode. The beauty is that the Linux kernel will always be written to a large extent in C. Rust won't replace the whole thing, at least within the next 20 years. But suffice it to say that Rust is slowly easing its way into the kernel. Given the fact that the Linux kernel is probably the most widely used operating system on the planet, not even counting mobile, I'm joking. It certainly has made its point with regards to being a better or a more, what's the word I'm looking for? Adopted C++. I mean, a lot of code is written in C++. You just have to take a look at GitHub. But I think Rust is rapidly gaining ground. But okay, the Rust Foundation hasn't send the check yet, so the marketing stops here. Rust Foundation, if you're looking for more marketing, apart from the upcoming episode, the email address is sponsor@linuxinlaws.eu. go right ahead. Please get in touch. But Martin, I'm sure you had some more thoughts beyond Rust.
What is there? What else is there beyond Rust? Anyway,
quite a few things.
I guess you've also made this. You've grown up with the internet, just like everybody else has on this podcast, and clearly browsing has become more of a let's say the way that everything is consumed, content consumed over time, right? That's you know if we whether it's cat videos or music, everything tends to be browser based. How did you foresee this happening, and did you actually how do you see this going forwards? Because you know we went through we always go in cycles in this industry anyway. Right?
Never, Martin. Never.
With client server and thin clients and thick clients and so on and so on, and moving more code into the browser and out of the browser, etc. Do you have a view on this or a plan?
Eric, before you answer this, Martin is always as old as I am, so that has to be put in perspective. Sorry, Eric, go right ahead.
Mature.
Yeah. Sorry, Eric, go right ahead.
I mean, this is like a very old, pattern, right?
Yeah.
I think, I'm sure you remember Java, but maybe you don't remember before that, News, the network window system on Sun, which was like downloadable PostScript, and they lost out to X11. So, this idea of downloadable code is like super old. I guess I would say like it was half a surprise to me. Like when I first saw the web, I think we realized that you could build powerful applications on it, but you'd have to build new capabilities to make it happen. I think if you told me, back in 1996 that you're going to see that's effectively the web be an operating system that you can run any application on and the people will be doing games on it, I think I would have, real like high quality games, I would have been kind of surprised. Just because it was such a clunky kind of artifact back then. I think that the power of the web is spontaneity, right? And it's low friction. And so you go to the site and you click on this and like it's perfect and like it's safe to download the thing and run it in your browser because the browser protects you and there's no download, there's no install experience, it just happens, right? And so that's the thing that the web is bringing to the party. And so anything that can be done compatibly with that is like a great candidate for being on the web. And the things that can't be done compatibly for that, and those good candidates. But I think what you see the project of the past 10 years has been to find the places that like people wanted to build apps for the web that they can't because the web is missing something, and then fill those things in. And so WebRTC is a great example of that. People wanted to build video conferencing for the web, but it was missing some key capabilities. And so the question was, what are the capabilities we have to put in there to make that work? And that's how you get, get user media, it's how you get peer connection, it's how you get the built-in, built-in codecs and echo cancellation, all those things. Those are like what's needed to make it work. And so on another front, you say, well, people want to build video games on the web. And so what do you need? You need a fast programming language, hence WebAssembly. You need to be able to do fast graphics, hence WebGL. And so I think that the trajectory we see is we'd like to see people do things on the web, and we'd like to ask, what are the applications that are most suitable for webifying that take advantage of that low friction and that safety, but that are for some reason too inconvenient to build? And how do we build those?
Eric, you got an absolute point there, because if you take a look at something called Chromebooks, that's exactly it. It's a minimal Linux kernel that just boots up a browser and then you're good to go. If you take a look at the numbers are just astonishing. Of course, Google does a fine job with pouring a lot of discount into the retail sector, especially in the education sector. But this concept has really taken off. Too bad it's not Firefox.
Yes. I mean, we did take a run at this. We had this project called Firefox OS that was designed to be kind of like a competitor to Android, but I think you can imagine how hard it is to compete with Android.
The app store never got really off the ground, did it?
No, it didn't. That project did not succeed. Though, some of the pieces of that project are still floating around in the code base from, got repurposed other things. I mean, that was the You were alluding earlier to, you know, Firefox being a multi-process browser. The original process separation work started there.
Changing onto more controversial issues, Chrome, and I'm not talking about Chromium now, to a certain extent Chrome is also affected, but Chrome does a fine job with turning the user into the product. Let's put it this way. I mean, if you take a look at the telemetry that is built into Chrome, it's a lot. And Google has certainly put a lot of money into marketing Chrome for a reason, I might add. If I take a look at what's the startup looking for, Martin?
How do you market Chrome?
It's simple. You put ads on TV and in print, and then you convince people to use that browser.
I've never seen an ad for Chrome, but
you're ringing in the wrong country,
Martin. Okay.
No, jokes aside, I mean, Chrome has, at least that was the case about 10 to 7 years ago, you could see Chrome ads on TV in print all over the place. Yeah. Yes. Where Google put a lot of money to marketing the browser for a reason, because of adoption. The website is, what is it, Eric, Stats Counter or Counter Stats or something?
Stat Counter,
yes. That gives an overview of the market share here. And if I take a look at this now, I did it about a month ago, Chrome captured about 66% of the market share. I reckon, and that's a fair play to Google, that they did a very good job at marketing Chrome in terms of its mobile, its desktop, its all the rest of it, never mind Chromebooks, to have that adoption. Because at the end of the day, they're not interested in selling Chromebooks, they're interested in your data, simple as that. I can recall a little bit of controversy about telemetry, but in Firefox, but that was only enabled in dev builds, not in production builds.
Well, so Firefox does have telemetry in production builds as well at this point.
Okay.
I think we're very careful and respectful of like what data we collect and what data we don't collect in telemetry. We document that. Like, I mean, it's open source, obviously, so you can see it. But you can also, if you're running Firefox and you go to the URL bar, you can type about:telemetry into the URL bar, and it will show you like exactly what's being gathered. And so I think, you know, we try to be like, you know, we have a set of principles about how we handle this, and we try to be respectful of what we gather and not gather, and try to avoid and don't gather user browsing history, for instance. I think my sense, you know, I don't work on Chrome. I have done some work on Chrome in the past, actually, when I was working on WebRTC. But, you know, my sense is that while Chrome does gather telemetry, that the telemetry itself is not really the privacy problem. I'm not saying I haven't looked at it in detail, but my sense is it's generally kind of not too terrible. But that rather, you know, the Chrome is designed, as you said, to drive you into the Google ecosystem and to ask you to log into Google, and so then you're using Google properties. And so I think what Chrome really does is it works hand in glove with Google properties to like get you to these Google stuff, right? And that's like not surprising. It's like one company, right? And those properties work really well on Chrome. And so I think that is like the impact, you know, in terms of like user privacy of Chrome is that fact, right? More so than like the telemetry practices.
Okay, something that has always been on my mind since version 57 of Firefox, the great API disaster. For those of you who don't know what this is all about, that's exactly, I think, and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, that came along with the taking of the new rendering engine into production. A lot of the extension APIs changed, meaning that your favorite extension all of a sudden didn't work anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think Firefox has historically been an incredibly extensible product. And it's really extensible in several ways. One of which is that, of course, it's open source. But the other is we had a very powerful extension API, which would let you do all kinds of things. And would let you, basically you could insert yourself in like, you could write an extension, they're called add-ons at the time, that you could insert yourself in like all kinds of parts of the browser processing anywhere you wanted. And so this was a very powerful capability, but it really depended, as you were mentioning earlier, on a particular architecture of Firefox that involved having everything be in one giant process. And that when it was like multiple processes, and now when it's in like one process, one process per origin, that became like really very hard to keep working. And so we sort of had to make a choice when we did, we did quantum. How much effort are we going to go through to make these extensions continue to work in the face of basic and architecture, which is like not really compatible with them? And at the same time, there was like a lot of Chrome market share, and there were Chrome, people could write extensions for Chrome using the Chrome add-on API. And that API was, because Chrome had been designed, you know, initially to be a multi-process browser, was much more compatible with that, with the kind of architecture we now had. And so it was just a lot easier, frankly, to cut over and use an API that was like mimic Chrome's than it was try to like make all that stuff work. And so it was a difficult choice when we finally made it, but it was just like either we like had to do an enormous amount of work or keep or hold back the release in order to make these things work when we weren't able to. And I think what I would say is I think we've done a pretty good job, though not a perfect job, of re-enabling capabilities that are important in our web extension APIs. And I guess I would say I don't know if you're putting my contact information in your show notes, but you're welcome to. And if people think there's some important piece of capability that should be an extension API that's not, like, they should contact me and we can take a look. But yeah, I know we broke a lot of people, and like I feel bad about that, but it was kind of like a difficult trade-off we had to make.
Final question on the good side from my side. SpiderMonkey versus what's it called? V8.
Yeah.
For those people who do not know, for the minority in the audience, we're talking about this unknown language called JavaScript, which that drives about 90% of the web applications that run in your browser. The rest is probably written in something called WebAssembly, which is slowly taking over. For a couple of decades, JavaScript has played a very important role in browser adoption. Google came up with something called, as I said, V8, that brought a lot of performance improvements to the table. There have been voices in the industry that say SpiderMonkey is dated. Any comments on this?
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think the industry goes through cycles where someone puts in a bunch of effort on something, and then other people like race to follow up. And so definitely Google put a lot of effort into V8, and then we had to race to follow up for a while. And then we've been putting a lot of effort into SpiderMonkey, and I think SpiderMonkey is a really, really excellent engine. So I think and some of the things you're saying are dated, we did remove. I don't think it's dated. No, I think I think competition here is healthy. I think that Google drove us to make SpiderMonkey faster by doing V8, and we're driving them to make V8 faster by making SpiderMonkey faster. And and every time WebAssembly gets faster because one of us does it, the other people have to race to catch up, and that's good for the user to have the system get faster overall.
But there are no plans of re-implementing the JavaScript engine in Rust to make it even more parallel.
No, not really. So I think
it's still written in C++ at the moment, right?
Yeah, I think so. I can get back to you on that, because it's something I don't work on very much. I think the thing to recognize about JavaScript is that there really are two performance properties you have to be interested in. One is how fast the engine itself runs, the part that does the compilation, and the second is how fast the code that is generated runs. And so you've got to sort of they both impact how fast the system is. And one of the big challenges because the JavaScript engine is so complicated is actually being able to understand like at a high level what the transformation, what the compilation process is doing, and optimize that compilation process rather than just optimizing the runtime of the compiler itself. And so a lot of the work we've done on SpiderMonkey, and again, I'm not an expert here, is to make that compilation process more transparent so that it gives us more opportunities to optimize the output code.
Excellent. Martin.
Yes, we talked about the browser and corporation, so we should also give the foundation some context. How do the two work together, and I guess how important is the foundation going forward with the Firefox usage declining, right? Unfortunately, so how much is being put into the foundation to make people aware of, as Chris mentioned, all the Let's say the bespoke browsers, the Chromes and Safaris that collect many of your data for other purposes. So is that part of the role to create awareness? Is it part of the role to make it more secure? How does that work with the corporation? Can you put a few words to that one, please?
Yeah. So I mean, first I should say I work for the corporation, not the foundation. Yes. So anything I say was sort of like from a slight remove. You know, what I see the foundation doing is what's often called civil society work, which is, you know, trying to use the platform of being Mozilla and the resources of being Mozilla to talk to people, you know, in the world about like technology and about how technology would develop well. And so certainly there's alignment in terms of like they think that having like a good Firefox is important. And so like we all agree on that matter. And so I think, you know, that there's some cooperation there. So I give you an example of something that they've done recently. They do this privacy not included guide, where they look at products and they look at the privacy practices, and they say, well, these products are like good, these products are bad. And I'm just looking at their site. They just did one on these mental health apps. And so I think, you know, that's an example where of real values alignment, where, you know, Mozilla think that privacy is a very important value for users and for people. And so, you know, the way the Mozilla Corporation does that is largely through products. The way that the foundation does it is largely through advocacy. And we also cooperate on those matters, especially when something technical needs to be looked at, where some of that capability maybe in the corporation rather than the foundation. But I think I see this as complementary, where, you know, if you want to change the world, you can't just do one thing. And so, you know, we're trying to change the world by making a product that is better for people and that influences the market. And they're trying to change the world by helping set the terms of public debate and engagement to understand why it's so important to have those changes made.
Okay, and it's wider than just, you know, browsers and internet usage.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I can sum this by memory, but, you know, it's about data, it's about AI, it's about connectivity in places that don't have good connectivity. I think that they're, you know, they have a very broad kind of view of like trying to make the internet and the web better.
I mean, you see this when you take a look at the website. It's Wikipedia tells me it's a proper 501c3. Martin, that reminds me, we must do an episode on the nonprofits.
We had some discussion about this recently.
Yes, indeed, Martin. And if you want to take the day off, sorry, not an option, I'm afraid. Okay, if I take a look at the foundation website, I see things like web monetization and other interesting projects come to mind that are way beyond the scope of the corporation, never mind the project, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess right.
Okay, care to elaborate on this in terms of, okay, you're not working for the definition, I get it, but the reason why I'm kind of going down that rabbit hole, essentially, where is Firefox going, not just from a corporation perspective, but also from a foundation perspective?
Thanks. That helps understand the question you're asking. I mean, so I think web monetization is an interesting case. I mean, it's probably useful to step back and talk about like the problem of the monetization of the web in general.
Exactly, but we should probably first explain what web monetization is in a foundation from a foundation perspective.
Well, let's talk about like let's even step further back than that and talk about how the web is funded. Right. So right now, the web is largely funded by advertising. Hmm.
Google comes to mind,
for instance, but not just Google. So you want to do a site, and you know, and maybe you can sell a Substack, but like maybe not. And what you probably do is you like sell some ads on your site, right? And then you know that those ads are sold by typically connecting with some ad network. So as you say, Google runs one, but there are others. And you know those ads, you know. And people don't like seeing ads. That's like, forget about that for a moment. The ads are like powered by like ubiquitous surveillance of like everybody on the internet and everybody think they're doing, which is bad.
And
people don't like seeing ads either, right? And so the question is there some way to fund, but on the other hand, they like having the web, you know? And so is there some way to have the web without the ads, or at least without the tracking? And so there's been a lot of interesting work over, you know, the past 10, 20 years about, like, is there some way to, like, people to monetize producing content on the web that doesn't involve, you know, doesn't involve any ads. And so if you're like, and so there's, and so like, if you're big, if you're like big and like the New York Times or the Washington Post, you can sell a subscription, or your Netflix, right? And if you're like tiny and you don't mind making a little money, maybe you don't like, you know, maybe you don't care, right? And, but if you like, if you want to like make, if you're medium sized, then it's actually a real problem for you. And so there's been a bunch of interesting work, as I said, over are there ways in which people can directly pay for content or indirectly perhaps, rather than pay for it by watching the ads, right? And so that's the space in which the web monetization work sort of comes into. And I think it's one angle on this problem, which is basically micropayments, right? And which is to say, you know, when I want to read this article on, you know, on Wired, I pay them a penny, right? Instead of having to buy a subscription to Wired, I pay them a penny to do it, right? And so, you know, I think there've been a bunch of reasons why historically micropayments haven't taken off, some of which are like technical and some of which are social. And I think it's like a little hard to know, frankly, whether or like, whether this version will take off. But like, as far as I can tell, web monetization is, you know, is a put on, can we try to like really attack the micropayments problem for the web? And so what I see them doing, and again, like this is not me, but I sort of am familiar with it. What I see them doing is, you know, is trying to like plant a bunch of seeds and see if any of the seeds sprout. And I think that's like probably, I think, you know, no one knows it's going to work here. So trying a lot of things is probably a pretty good idea.
Going forward, where do you see this going?
Well, I think, you know, there's Firefox and the foundation. I think the best case scenario for this would be, the win scenario would be that the foundation's work and this grant program gets to the point where it's pretty clear there's one angle it's going to work. And then when that angle is going to work, then it's something that browsers can start looking at, you know, actually incorporating. We've been a bit hesitant in the past to try to take a flyer in individual things, because like the cost to us of doing anything new is like really high. And when you put, and like, I don't know if like you work on a product like a browser, but one of the things about a browser is that like people expect that to change. And so if we were to like add, you know, a particular web monetization API today, then if we took it out in like 6 months, people are gonna be really mad at us. And so, you know, I think we're quite cautious about what we put in as like browser APIs. But I think that the good outcome, a positive outcome, would be that this work creates critical mass for one system. And then that system is something we could all could adopt in.
Totally, that has been more than insightful. Totally speculating now. If I take a look at history,
I thought I was speculating already.
No, let me do some speculating for a change.
Okay.
If I take a look at history, and as we all know, history tends to repeat itself left, right, and center. When Microsoft developed something called Internet Explorer, some of the key components were actually part of the operating system that allowed Internet Explorer to have very short startup times, because most of the stuff was up and running already. Now, if I take a look at something called Chrome OS with a browser called Chrome, pretty much booted up on, but upon kind of login, as in you boot up the operating system, which is a minimal Linux kernel, and before you know it, Chrome is up and running. This is full circle, more or less. Now, the very tentative, the visionary question I have, not tentative, but rather visionary, the visionary question I have for you, Eric, where do you see the browser in 10 years' time? Never mind mobile or not.
I think I like to think of myself as a pragmatist. And so I think, you know, maybe we're going to see radical changes, but this is a pretty mature product that has, you know, has not changed appreciably in 10 years from a, you know, from like a sort of overall like perspective. What it's gotten is much faster and more capable, but like the sort of general shape of the browser is like unchanged. So I think, you know, we actually published a document maybe month and a half ago that was called, like, that we had the grandiose title of like Mozilla's vision for the web, that I think covers a lot of the material that sort of you and I have been talking about in this conversation. But I think what we sort of think is actually the browser is like pretty good, but that the web is kind of going off the rails, and that and that, you know, the browser's job is to largely bring the web back onto the rails. And so We could talk, you know, and we talked about a few of the things here, like the ubiquitous surveillance of powers advertising. Something we haven't talked so much about is the concentration of data and authority in a very small number of companies in a way that is actually quite hard for you to like get out. The you know, how difficult it's become as an individual to publish your own data without going through one of those silos. So I think those are things that like that we need to repair. But I think they're like, I think, and the browser plays an important role in those in terms of building the technical foundations for making that possible and for encouraging those things to happen. But I think almost like, I want to ask the bigger question of like, where can the web go? And what I'd like the web to go is in a much more kind of democratic and, you know, broad-based kind of situation than what we're seeing now.
That nicely brings us to the proxies, Martin, unless you have to add something, or you want to add something rather.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a bit more...
more philosophical, okay? Martin, go ahead.
No, I want to go back. Less philosophical.
We have another 2 hours, so that's fine. Indeed. Go right ahead.
So, from a user's perspective, what do you see as a major improvement coming in the next few years? I mean, we've seen the tabs there. Obviously, that's something that's been widely used, and we've seen profiles that are... movable between devices, etc. Do you see any other big development that's going to make users' life easier on your horizon?
I think it's a little too early to say, honestly.
That's fair. I just wonder if you have stuff on your roadmap already.
I don't think we're there yet. I think what I would tease here is I would say that there's a real consciousness that it's gotten harder and harder, and the number of sites and the number of things people are expected to do on the web has gotten harder and harder to manage. And that, you know, that the solution is not like to have a bazillion tabs and to have them like in a giant tree. and that we should do something about tabs, that.
Yes.
We should do something about that. But like, I think that the exact answer to that is still TBD.
Okay.
Not even deep speech or other, some cool AI stuff comes to something?
Well, I think that, you know, that's interesting.
I'm sorry, full disclosure, I'm normally the one to ask controversial questions. Martin is tamer. I'm just saying.
I think speech is still trying to find its niche. Like, obviously, we see a lot of speech-based applications like Siri and Assistant, but, you know, I think people kind of thought they were going to have the Star Trek computer, and they don't. And there's still a lot of people using the mouse and the Windows. So Firefox, like we have a mobile browser, which like has a fair number of users, but like Firefox is like still like dominantly a desktop product. And I think in a desktop product, it's a little hard to understand right now where speech fits in, right? And it's understand on a mobile product, it kind of makes, like, I think there's a lot more like people like, okay, you know, Siri, take me to, you know, Siri, take me to Starbucks or whatever. But I think, you know, on desktop product, people are sitting in front of the product. And so I'm certainly not saying there's no role for speech. I'm saying that we need to figure out what that role for speech is, because I think right now it kind of feels like it's an afterthought.
So what interface in terms of having a browser, never mind a smartphone directly tied into your nervous system, still some way down to go?
Well, that's what I'm hoping for, is the nervous system thing.
Okay, Eric, we at the end of the show, we sometimes, or most of the time, actually do something called the proxies, which stands for pick of the week. So anything goes. Something Martin normally does. Martin, what do you normally do?
I don't have a normal.
B movies, right? Like okay, splatter things.
This is you.
I normally do A movies, like the stuff you think about. No, joke aside. No, but anything goes. on the episode where we had the Electronic Frontier Foundation of Georgia on the show, I basically, my pox was the founding fathers of the U.S., basically who wrote the Constitution. So really anything goes. It refers to something that has come across your path recently, as within the last 100 years or something. We normally take a fortnight into account, but it's worth mentioning. So anything goes, really. Eric, go ahead.
Sure. Well, I will take a moment to pitch this science fiction author. His name is Peter Watts, W-A-T-T-S.
And he has links amazing, will be in the show notes, yes.
And he has an amazing book called Blindsight, which I don't even know where to start. It's about vampires and about incomprehensible aliens and the nature of consciousness and whether the future needs us or not. And it's brilliant, incredibly depressing, but it's brilliant. I read a lot of science fiction and people ask me what to read and I tell them to read Peter Watts.
Okay, but you're not talking about the Senate now. You're talking about some fictitious entity. I'm joking.
It is fictitious, yeah.
How would you compare it to other science fiction authors, kind of style-wise? Is that?
So it's like, it's very hard science fiction. Watts is actually a biologist, and so like there's like footnotes at the end of the book that describe, you know, describe everything he's talking about. It's not an easy read because he's really like, he really wants to talk about, you know, he wants to explore these issues. He wants to explore. I'm serious about like the nature of consciousness. And one of the big Watts themes is like, is consciousness adaptive or is it just like a bug in your system and should we get rid of it? So it's good stuff. As I say, it's really depressing, but it's good stuff.
Okay. Martin. Excellent. Yes. Your POX, if you have.
My POX. Yes, of course.
Yes. Of course. Excellent.
So my POX is... it's not so much the Postcrisis conference I went to, but more the fact of
me. Oh no! Here we go again, Postcrisis.
Talking to them in person, which is it's been a long time.
Non-COVID, I see. Okay, go ahead.
Non-COVID in-person.
Yes. Can we expect some YouTube clips or something about the event? Maybe even about the after-show gig or something.
Okay, probably. But then I'd have to use YouTube, which.
Links may or may not be in the show notes, people. You never know.
Indeed. What about yourself?
It's probably a fair guess to say they won't be in the show notes.
Yes.
My POX is actually something called the
Dukes of Hazzard. Yeah.
Yes, it's the Mozilla Foundation came up with a Mozilla manifesto that contains principles and pledges. And these 10 principles basically lay out what is important for humankind in an internet context. And it's 10 principles. Links, of course, in contrast to Martin's shenanigans, will be in the show notes. And the one that really struck me as probably being the most important principle is actually the second principle. And let me quote this. The internet is a global public resource that must remain open and accessible. And why is that important? Because that basically treats the internet like a basic utility, like water, energy, you have it, and maybe even free speech and freedom in general. This is a core principle. The second thing that comes to mind is principle number 7. Free and open source software promotes the development of the internet as a public resource. That goes hand in hand. What this actually says, as in the combination, is that open source drives the internet and thus fosters innovation. There's a couple of interesting pledges, details will be in the show notes, but this is my POX for the week. Eric, I would like to thank you for being on the show. That has been more than interesting, let's put it this way. And keep up the good work.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
This is the Linux In-Laws.
You come for the knowledge.
But stay for the madness.
Thank you for listening.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for the song Solid Market, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.